In the matter of West Pleasant versus U.S. Home Corporation, can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honor. Chief Greenberg, Light Department Greenberg, New York, on behalf of the defendant.
Good morning, Your Honor. Robert Washburn, of counsel to the Cherry Hill Law Firm, Flash Greenberg.
Good morning, Your Honor. Deborah Plyer, sole practitioner, on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, West Pleasant CPGT Inc., individually and as assignee of 4G's Land LLC.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Greenberg.
Thank you, Chief Justice Ravner, and may it please the court, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal if necessary. Until today, every New Jersey case that has allowed a fair market value credit involved a party that obtained both a property and the monetary value of that property. That's not so here. U.S. Home forewent a deficiency action and ended up only with properties worth far less than what it was owed. Unlike in every other case in this area, there was a real-time valuation of these properties in 2010. At that time, 4G's, one of the plaintiffs here, went to trial in the bankruptcy court on issues where valuation was central. The result there was a finding by the bankruptcy judge after a full trial that the two properties together were worth barely $1.2 million, well below the amount that U.S. Home was owed. So there was a shortfall here, not a windfall, to U.S. Home. The bankruptcy court's valuation should have been preclusive in this case. Plaintiff's own expert testimony in the law division from two appraisers was that the market hadn't changed materially from June 2010, when the bankruptcy court made its finding, to December 2010 and January 2011, when the sheriff's sales of these properties occurred. So the bankruptcy court valuation was the identical issue presented in these matters. It was actually litigated in the bankruptcy court, and it resulted in a final judgment, so that all elements of either res judicata or collateral estoppel were satisfied. The appellate division mistakenly found a windfall here because U.S. Home acquired two properties. But the two properties were essentially one, as the record reflects. They were contiguous, and it was contemplated that they would be the subject of the same overall development. They were also the subject of one purchase contract. Had the two properties been sold simultaneously, the result would have been the same, a shortfall to U.S. Home, not a windfall. If the properties in question were worth in 2010 what the plaintiffs here now say they were worth in hindsight, plaintiffs would have bid or gotten others to bid, as U.S. Home urged them to do, and as indeed was their legal obligation in this context. West Pleasant, though, knew that the properties didn't have the value they now claim at the time. In fact, West Pleasant asserted in an October 2010 counterclaim against 4G's, they were litigating against each other in a separate case. West Pleasant said that the value of its property would, quote, likely be inadequate, close quote, to satisfy U.S. Home's judgment. U.S. Home just wanted its money repaid. The plaintiffs prevented that by their pattern of conduct. U.S. Home had to settle for properties that at the time and for years later as we emerged from the Great Recession had little value. Plaintiffs now want to complete the injustice by inflicting on U.S. Home a multi-million dollar payment to plaintiffs, the persistent wrongdoers. So there are many reasons why the judgment of the appellate division should be reversed. First, New Jersey law does not recognize fair market value credits other than where someone gets both a property and the monetary value of the property through a deficiency action. That's the law not only here in New Jersey, but elsewhere as well, and it's also the view of commentators, as you've seen from the briefing. If this court were inclined to alter the law, this case is a uniquely unsuitable vehicle to do that. Here, there is a final judgment of the bankruptcy court that, unlike in the other cases where value had to be the subject of speculation after the fact, the bankruptcy court, mere months before the sheriff's sales, had a trial and ruled on valuation. Because there was a shortfall and not a windfall, no fair market value credit would be proper here, even if the court were to change the law as to when fair market value credits are available on proper facts. If it were appropriate to apply a fair market value credit here, it should only have zeroed out the plaintiff's obligations to U.S. Home. That's where the parties put themselves after the sheriff's sales, the last of which was in January 2011, 9 years ago. At that time, plaintiffs gave up the ghost, and U.S. Home decided not to pursue a deficiency. Equity, if applied, should leave the parties where they put themselves. Finally, fair market value credits can be given only to parties who themselves conducted their conduct conducted themselves equitably. West Pleasant and 4G's did not. They breached their contract with U.S. Home and forced U.S. Home into arbitration, then to the law division, then to the appellate division, then to the bankruptcy court in order to vindicate U.S. Home's rights. West Pleasant and 4G's lost at every stage, and deservedly so. West Pleasant entered into a consent order in the bankruptcy court under which it was barred from contesting valuation further. 4G's went to trial and lost on its argument about the equity in the property and the claimed valuations. Neither West Pleasant nor 4G's appealed that ruling of the bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy court, when it ruled, said that it was okay for U.S. Home to foreclose and to conduct sheriff sales, and that's what U.S. Home did. They complied with all legal requirements in doing so. But continuing their inequitable conduct, West Pleasant and 4G's forum shopped away from federal court after losing in the bankruptcy court and sued in state court mere months later. West Pleasant did that in violation of its consent order and the agreement that it signed. 4G's did that in violation of the bankruptcy court's final, unappealed, and binding valuation ruling. Plaintiffs then played fast and loose with the law division at the two valuation trials. At the 4G's valuation trial that came first, plaintiffs treated the two properties together for purposes of generating the highest possible valuation of the 4G's parcel. But when it came time for the West Pleasant valuation trial next, plaintiffs flip-flopped and valued the West Pleasant parcel as a separate development, again trying to maximize artificially the value of the properties. Those trials, with that manipulative conduct by the plaintiffs, produced valuations that were triple or quadruple what the bankruptcy court had found in real time in 2010. In fact, the 4G's figure even far exceeded 4G's own appraisal in 2010 of that property, which was at $1.69 million. The law division proceedings resulted in a figure that was almost 50% higher, showing the difficulties of trying to retroactively value properties.
Mr. Greenberg, if the $4 million or so valuation at the time of the sheriff's sale that the law division came up with was correct, and I know you don't accept that, would this be an appropriate case? Would the result that you're seeking be equitable?
The result that we're seeking would be equitable, Your Honor, and in keeping with existing New Jersey law for several reasons. First of all, there still would not be any deficiency action sought by U.S. Home. When parties buy properties at sheriff sales, it's an open market. At that time, if the properties were in fact worth $4 million or any figure other than what the bankruptcy court determined, parties including these plaintiffs and the public would have been able to bid. They did not, even though U.S. Home urged them to bid, and even though, as Judge Dreyer pointed out in the National Community Bank case, it's the obligation of the mortgagor or the debtor to try to procure bidders at a sheriff's sale. That didn't happen because the properties were not worth that. But accepting the hypothetical, Your Honor, that the properties were worth $4 million, there was no deficiency. We draw a bright line, and so do other jurisdictions and commentators, between purchasing at a sheriff's sale and also seeking a deficiency judgment.
Of course.
When you buy a property at a sheriff's sale, the property value can change subsequently and perhaps favorably. The purchaser is not penalized for that fact, and that's another thing Judge Dreyer said in the National Community Bank case. I'm sorry, Justice.
It's Allen. Okay. You remember the stock market 2 weeks ago? Things change.
valuation changes. How you would value the stock market 2 weeks ago is a lot different than it would be now. So we had the bankruptcy court did a valuation, I don't know, six months before the foreclosure?
It was 6 months before the first sheriff's sale, 5.5, 6 months before the first, and 6 months before
real estate values change. Do you agree? And sometimes they can markedly change, rising and falling. Yes?
I agree in concept. But the actual testimony of the plaintiff's appraisers here, they were asked that specific question. Was there a material change between June 2010 and December 2010 or January 2011 when the two sheriffs sailed?
So I want to ask you a question about that. Are you challenging the sufficiency of the evidence that supported the Law Division's valuation of the 4G property? Is that one of the issues that you're petitioning this court?
This is not a sufficiency of the evidence challenge.
Okay, so putting aside the res judicata, collateral estoppel issue, for purposes of the arguments this morning, do we accept the valuation by the Law Division as being correct?
We don't accept it as being applicable. I don't want to say that the valuation was correct or incorrect. On its own terms,
it's not challenged.
It's not challenged.
And how much was the valuation of the 4G's property?
$2.398 million,
okay.
If I recall.
And your judgment against West Pleasant and 4G's was for how much?
At the time of the sheriff's sales, about $1.7 million in change.
Okay, so the issue is, like, why should you get a windfall? Your adversary is saying, of course, you weren't seeking a valuation because you purchased it for $400, the property. Like, why should you make a windfall?
Well, it's not a windfall, Justice Alvin, to say that properties that were purchased at a time where all parties believed, based number one on the bankruptcy court valuation and number two on the party's conduct, plaintiff's conduct and others in not seeking to bid, all parties believed that in the depths of the Great Recession at that time, these properties were very low value. So it was no windfall looking at it at the time that people purchased that U.S. Home purchased the properties for $100 each with no other bidders. The fact that thereafter the value of the properties went up doesn't mean that there's a windfall. The case law here and elsewhere has uniformly said that there is a windfall only when a mortgagee or a creditor obtains both the property and the value of the property.
It's a question of equity.
Should the most recent valuation be the one that controls?
The most recent valuation, Justice Fernandez-Vina, might control if there had not been a conclusive valuation in real time, right about the time of the sheriff's sales, within a couple of months. Recall that in the MMU case that has been cited extensively by the plaintiffs, the value of that property 1 month after the sheriff's sale was considered to be the applicable value. So the courts, at least the appellate division in that case, don't limit themselves to a valuation that was strictly on the date of the sheriff's sale. It's reasonable to apply the values that were calculated in June 2010 by the bankruptcy court after a trial with witnesses that was never appealed, and to make that be the binding value.
Why didn't you seek a deficiency motion? That's what your adversary is saying. You didn't seek it because you didn't want the valuation. How do you respond to that?
The record reflects that U.S. Home, quite frankly, to use a colloquialism, was sick of dealing with West Pleasant and 4G's. They were sick of being dragged through different courts and being manipulated by parties who stopped at nothing to try to block U.S. Home from its rights, and they decided not to throw good money after
bad. If we accept your argument, then for $100, you're able to purchase property worth $2.5 million approximately, and also still pursue a judgment for $1.7 million against 4G's.
We didn't pursue a judgment.
But you'd have a right. Since you did not seek a deficiency action, you still had your $1.7 million judgment that you could have pursued, correct?
But we did not. And that's a dispositive fact. All of the cases that have been cited by the plaintiffs or that are in the books that we all know about involved circumstances where there was literally a double recovery.
Do you still have a $1.7 million judgment? Are you sitting on a $1.7 million judgment against them? If we were to accept your argument, would you still have the property and would you still be sitting on a $1.7 million judgment?
I think by now that we've waived that judgment.
Because you've not executed it?
Because of the passage of time and because of the position that U.S. Home has taken throughout this litigation that they're not pursuing a deficiency judgment. We would turn ourselves into West Pleasant or 4Gs if we were to turn on a dime now and say, after all these years of claiming we're not pursuing it, now we're going to. We would have played fast and loose with the courts.
So is your position not that there is no room in equity for fair market value credits at the time of a share of sale?
There is room for fair market value credit, Justice Slovakia, when a party is unjustly enriched by a double recovery, the most common circumstance of which, and perhaps the only, but there might be others, mm-hmm. is where a party recovers both a property and the value of the property. That's literally a double recovery. Mm-hmm.
So we're not limited by the terms of the statute. There is room for equity to act.
There's room for equity to act on proper facts if the court changes the case law to date.
Well, what about DeMarco?
DeMarco really was just about the distinction between bonds and notes. Even there...
But it went beyond that and dealt with a statute that was limited in nature and recognized the existence of a possibility of action in equity. And for that reason, I think it's important that our court spoke to that issue, even in arguably dicta way back when.
Well, it was dicta. As one of my law school professors would say, it perhaps was magnificent dicta, mm-hmm. but it was dicta. Mm-hmm. It's open to this court to adopt that dicta and to do something different with it. But looking at the equitable factors here mm-hmm. and the overall context of the situation, you have parties who conducted themselves inequitably and have no call on equity. You have no double recovery here. And so DeMarco's indication that in proper circumstances equity could provide relief and a remedy, whether applicable more generally or not, is not applicable here.
May I ask one follow-up question, please, on that same theme? If we were to recognize that kind of use of equity at a share of sale for fair market value credit, do you think it should be required to be done on the basis of an objection so that there's proper notice and everything is teed up correctly?
Yes, we do, and that's one of the arguments that we made in the appellate division, that the appellate division gave very short shrift.
Mm-hmm.
Under the court rule, the idea is that people should object anyway, and West Pleasant should not even have been able to come in considering that there was no such objection.
Our court rules do speak, though, in terms of notice on objection, and I didn't see any other way in which that issue could be raised.
Right, that was exactly the argument that we made in the appellate division, and that continues to be the case today.
Okay.
If there's room for equity, as you say, when there's a double recovery, why is there no room, logically, for equity when facts similar to this, and again, let's accept what we have from the law division, show the recovery of two properties with a fair market value of in excess of $4 million to cover a debt of $1.7
million? Because the reality is, Chief Justice Ravner, that the two properties were one property. There would have been no difference here if the two properties had been sold at the same time. They were not, as the law division found unsurprising, because properties with a mortgage need to go through more process before a sheriff's sale could be conducted, as compared to the 4G's property that had no mortgage. But if the properties had been sold together essentially as one property, we would have been in the same situation as we are now with the two properties.
So it sounds from your answer that you're arguing with the value of the property and the way that they're packaged. I'm asking that we accept the law division's findings, that the worth was in excess of $4 million. Why, from a common sense standpoint, wouldn't that be considered a windfall that equity can step in for?
Well, if we consider it a windfall, if we consider it in any way improper, although National Community Bank let us know that even when somebody profits to the extent of millions of dollars from buying at a sheriff's sale, the courts have nothing to say. The most that should have occurred would have been to zero out the obligation that West Pleasant and 4G's had to impose on U.S. Home, who at all points was the innocent party, did only what the bankruptcy court authorized it to do, and was victimized at every turn by these plaintiffs, to require U.S. Home to be subjected to a seven-figure damages judgment in favor of these plaintiffs is completely inequitable.
You've raised on your issue preclusion theme argument that the bankruptcy court's valuation should be considered preclusive as to any later valuation. Two issues have been raised, as far as I can tell, about that. One is timing, which has been alluded to in the prior questions. It wasn't on the date of the sheriff's sale, and as Justice Albin, the stock expert over here, notes, that a lot can change in a short time. And the other is that the bankruptcy court's valuation is done for a very limited purpose, and that's simply to determine whether a party has equity in the property. It's not about any sort of detailed fair market value evaluation. What's your response to that second argument?
Well, I don't agree, Justice Patterson, that it's not a detailed valuation. The bankruptcy court had before it the same expert appraisal testimony that any court would have in what we might call a more formal or a more direct litigation about valuation. The bankruptcy court had all that testimony. There was examination and cross-examination, and the fact is that the stock market analogy that that we're talking about is not really the analogy that we need to be looking at.
Very basic level on the timing, should the valuation be on the date of the sheriff's sale, as your adversaries contend?
The valuation need not be on the exact date. In fact, I don't know how it ever would be, because by that
or
time...
Or for that date, rather. Yeah, it wouldn't be done on
that time,
the date.
By that time, judicial proceedings are done.
Right.
In the first union case, this court said that preclusive doctrines like res judicata and collateral estoppel apply not requiring that the issues be identical, but that they merely be substantially overlapping, closely related, or have a high degree of similarity. That's what we're saying here. The idea that the difference between June 2010 and December 2010 is dispositive is not in keeping with First Union. It's not in keeping with the testimony here where plaintiff's own appraiser said there was no material difference.
Going to the bankruptcy court's process, do you agree that the bankruptcy judge, when making that determination as to fair market value, was not thinking this is going to be determinative of the amount that various parties actually get? I have a threshold determination here that I have to make. A yes or no question, is there equity? And that's all I have to decide.
Well, we don't know what was in the bankruptcy judge's mind,
right.
But we do know that the issue of value was placed directly in issue by both West Pleasant and 4G's. Only 4G's went to trial. They placed that valuation issue before the court for adjudication. The argument that it was done for one purpose and not for another purpose does not overcome preclusive doctrines, because the court necessarily had to make a decision on valuation. The valuation issue was actually litigated to a final judgment, and the valuation issue is the same one that West Pleasant and 4G's proceeded to bring to the law division because they didn't want to appeal the bankruptcy court's adverse ruling. So under this court's preclusive jurisdiction, the bankruptcy court's valuation, regardless of what particular purpose might have underlain it, is binding, especially because that valuation was solicited by the plaintiffs themselves.
Have you ever argued that had your client the foresight to know that they were going to get stuck with this fair market valuation of $2.5 million, I wouldn't have purchased the property? I thought I was getting it for $100, and now you're telling me it's $2.5 million. Go ahead.
Well, and that's an important point, Justice Albin, in terms of the practicalities of the industry and the way that these processes work. Parties are entitled to rely on the results of a sheriff's sale in real time, when the public is able to bid, when parties who are particularly knowledgeable about the properties and who now claim in hindsight for their own benefit that the properties were worth triple or quadruple what the bankruptcy court found, those parties were able to bid at the sheriff's sale. and they had an obligation to get bidders if they were not going to bid.
Can you explain to us, like, why the rest of the bidding public was so ignorant? I mean, that you were able to throw in $100 to get something for $2.5 million?
Well, it's not a matter
of... I seen that public notice, I might have been down there.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the points that I think has pervaded this case. No one thought that the properties were worth $2.5 million. We've accepted that hypothetical in different numbers, $4 million and some other numbers, for purposes of the argument today. But at the time of the sheriff's sale, these players, the parties represented in this courtroom, knew only that the bankruptcy court had found a value of a little over $1.2 million. The larger real estate market was paralyzed. There was appraisal testimony before the law division that the development market in Jackson was overstuffed with properties that were ready to be developed or even had approvals. Nothing was being built because, as we all recall, the Great Recession was a time when the real estate markets were literally paralyzed. So at that time, no one thought that the property was worth bidding on.
Unless you had a judgment on the property.
We had a judgment on the property.
So any bidder was going to have to satisfy your judgment.
Exactly. So
and that happens a lot with foreclosed properties.
It does. It's not uncommon. It's not that the public is stupid or that the debtors or the mortgagors are stupid. There was a belief shared by all at the time that the properties were not really worth very much. In fact, U.S. Home didn't want the properties themselves.
But they were worth more than $100.
They were worth presumably more than $100, but many, many cases at foreclosure sales or other sheriff sales, Justice Timpone, end up being bought for $100 because there's no interest practically by buyers.
Why didn't you at least, since you made so much of the bankruptcy valuation, why didn't you at least purchase it for the amount that was valued by the bankruptcy court? Why did you just throw in $100?
I think the reality of a sale, Justice Albin, is that people are looking to buy for the lowest available value that the market will allow, and the market allowed a bid of $100.
So I understand this, and I'm going to repeat myself. I'm going back, so forgive me. But that allows you to buy the property for $100, property that is valued at hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars more money, and then to retain your $1.7 million judgment against the debtor. And there seems to be something really wrong about that.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that as long as the buyer doesn't pursue another remedy that would allow for a double recovery. And that's what U.S. Home did here. Now, regardless of their motive, which, as I indicated, was they wanted to be rid of these counterparties and didn't want to throw good money after bad.
But your judgment is what forced that price down, right? The fact that you had a judgment at that point would keep a bidder, let's say someone who's interested in developing the property, that bidder knows if they buy the property for $1 million, they're going to have to worry about what your client's owed.
That would be true of anyone at any foreclosure sale or any sheriff's sale. By definition, there has been a judgment of some amount that's out there. There's nothing inequitable about that. That's our system. I'm sorry.
If the trial court had used the bankruptcy court evaluation of the property, would you have an argument today?
If the trial court had used the bankruptcy court valuation
of one point whatever,
$1.2 million in change, that amount was less than what was owed to U.S. Home. This lawsuit that we're here about today could never have gotten started because there would be no basis for a claim of a fair market
value. What you would have done in that example is you would have instituted a deficiency action to make up the difference. You would say, okay, $1.2 million, I'm owed $500,000, and you still would have pursued the debtor, no?
Well, now I'm going to get into the realm of speculation, and I apologize for that in response to your question, Justice Albin. But on the basis of the way U.S. Home conducted itself, they were not interested in pursuing further remedies against these plaintiffs. They had been dragged through the legal mud for a long time. There's testimony in the record from Mr. Campbell, who's one of the principals of West Pleasant, about the extent to which 4Gs had dragged U.S. Home through the legal mud and had cost it all kinds of money and time and various other expenses. From what I know based on the record, And in response to your hypothetical, U.S. Home would not have done that because they didn't want to have any more of West Pleasant or 4Gs after all they had been through, whether it's for a $500,000 deficiency judgment or a $1.7 million judgment. They wanted to walk away. That was all they wanted to do. They couldn't get their money. They settled for properties that were not worth very much, and they walked away. Now they're here many, many years later having to be threatened with a seven-figure judgment by the very parties who wronged them. They were not looking to perpetuate that.
So do I understand your argument correctly that if any other party had bought this property than you, your client, and your judgment still existed out there, that party might have to pay the judgment that was owed to your client, but wouldn't have to lose the additional value in the property, correct? They would have whatever the property was worth. However, excuse me, your adversary doesn't bid, so pays nothing, loses the value of your judgment, and gets more money by a judgment that you have to pay to the client as a result of not having bid on this property. Is that correct? They're standing in a better place than any other purchaser would have been had it not been your client.
That appears to be correct, Justice Lovecchia. And the injustice of that, as you stated, is magnified by the fact that those parties have no claim on any equitable result.
Right.
Can I ask for one clarification? At the very beginning, you talked about the value. I actually have a question after my clarification. You talked about the valuation of the property in the bankruptcy court, and it was valued as a single property, not as two separate properties, which inflated the price in the law division. Did you say that?
I may have misspoken, Justice Solomon, but that's not what I meant to say
okay.
If I said it.
They were valued separately.
They were valued separately. One property was valued at a little bit over $400,000.
And the other at $800,000.
That's the West Pleasant property. The 4G's property was valued at a little over $800,000 for a total of a little 1. Over 1.2
million.
My question is, if you at that point had maintained and pursued your deficiency judgment of 1.7 million, saw a collection of that, we wouldn't be here today either, would we?
We would be here.
Well, we might, but
we would not be here together, if I understand.
Okay, yeah, that's what I meant. Thank you for clarification.
He's just wishful thinking on his part.
I have that effect on a lot of people.
But you would be in a very different position because you would still have the $1.7 million judgment, correct?
Right.
Okay, so getting back to what Justice Lovecchia said, as you stand here before us, you agree that there's no way to pursue your $1.7 million judgment. Yes?
We have, in my view, long since given that
up. Let's assume you did. As a matter of equity, forget whether you did or you didn't. As a matter of equity, you don't dispute that $1.7 million judgment could be extinguished and the parties walk away. They got the $1.7 million benefit of this judgment, and you don't have to pay anything. In other words, they never satisfied your judgment. By walking away, they essentially received that benefit that they're seeking here today.
If I understand the question.
Not sure I understand the question.
The question is whether it would be a result that U.S. Home would either advocate for
result.
Or accept a result today that would result in no judgment against U.S. Home, reversal of the judgment below in that regard, and an extinguishment or a vacation of whatever 1.7 or other million-dollar judgment that U.S. Home had. The answer is yes.
So your statement, I think, to us was, that's an equitable result. Leaving you with a seven-figure judgment in favor of the other party, that is not equitable.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So you say the windfall, there's no windfall. Sorry, Chief.
No, it's all right.
If you are not pursuing that judgment, there's effectively no windfall involved.
That's right. There is no windfall, regardless of how the properties are valued in terms of whether the bankruptcy court valuation or the law division valuation would be accepted.
Mr. Greenberg, we'll have you back for rebuttal. Is there anything you wanted to add at this point?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Washburn.
May it please the Court. The New Jersey State Builders Association believes that the appellate division opinion does potential serious damage to the debt and equity markets on which our members rely. Our members require a stable and predictable financial and lending markets. That's the lifeblood of our industry. Our members are most often borrowers. They'll borrow money from a financial institution for site development, construction, and therefore we're concerned about the effect of this opinion on lenders. But our members also function as lenders. If we build a project and sell it, we often take back a mortgage. So we are sort of on both sides. We're borrowers and lenders, depending on the nature of the transaction. Here's the headlines of our concerns with the Appellate Division opinion. First, we believe there should be no fair market value credit in a mortgage or judgment foreclosure action unless the lender seeks a deficiency judgment. Second, if the court decides that a fair market value credit is available in this kind of action, we believe the credit must be sought and the value determined contemporaneously with the sheriff's sale and not years later in a greatly improved real estate market, which is what happened in this case. And third, if the court decides that a fair market value credit is available, at most that credit should result in satisfaction of the outstanding debt and not form the basis of a monetary judgment against the lender or the creditor. We believe that the Appellate Division inhibits for the foreclosure process and thus lending because it makes lenders subject to a fair market value credit even if they don't seek a deficiency judgment. The debtor can recover a monetary judgment against the lender, and the fair market valuation can occur years after the sheriff's sale. Why would a lender foreclose if the result would be a large judgment against that lender on behalf of the debtor? The Appellate Division opinion, if you think about it, encourages a debtor to wait an indefinite period of time, and when the market improves, seek a monetary judgment against the lender. The real estate market depends upon ready availability of debt and equity financing on reasonable terms. All of the cases in this area recognize that there has to be a balance between the rights of the debtor and the availability of reasonable credit for borrowers. We believe that the Appellate Division opinion greatly tipped that balance in favor of debtors at the expense of lenders.
Let me ask you a question about your first point, which is that there should be no fair market credit unless the lender seeks a deficiency judgment. That leaves all the cards in the hands of the lender, does it not? In other words, if the lender strategically decides that a fair market value credit could work against it on whatever the facts of the particular case are, I'm not talking about this particular case, the lender can just hold back and let it play out knowing that it's never going to be faced with a fair market value credits if it doesn't file for deficiency judgment.
Yes, Justice Patterson, but as in this case, a lender who does not seek a deficiency judgment is essentially bidding the amount of the debt against the property. If I bid $100 and have $1 million judgment, don't seek a deficiency judgment, right. I'm bidding $1,100,000.
Right. But there could be situations where letting everything sit as it is because of the way the sheriff's sale plays out could result in a windfall. Am I right about that?
I think the New Jersey case law defines a windfall or a double recovery only when the lender applies for a deficiency judgment. The cases seem to say that there's no double recovery in the absence of a deficiency judgment. If you look at the cases that are cited by the respondent on page 4 of the respondent's brief in reply to NJBA's brief, the Lowenstein case says that. The 79-83 13th Avenue DeMarco case on page 5 says there's no windfall without a deficiency judgment. The Mossmeer case on page 6, the creditor sought satisfaction of their judgment. the Citibank case on page 8, there was a deficiency action. So all of these cases that talk about double recovery do so in the context of a deficiency judgment.
Right. But obviously at issue here is in part the application of equitable principles. And, you know, you're the expert on this, and we appreciate your advice on it. Aren't there situations where it would be strategically to the advantage of a bank, a lender, in a foreclosure setting, to hold off on the deficiency judgment because the application of fair market value credits could end up hurting the lender much more than the value of that deficiency judgment? Is that an unlikely scenario, or is that something
that could
happen?
No, I think it's possible that could happen.
Okay.
But again, without a deficiency judgment, what the bid on the property is isn't the nominal bid that most sale purchasers would make. It is basically the balance of the indebtedness.
No, right, and obviously that's factored into the fairness of what was bought.
Yes.
This property wasn't bought for combined $200. Everybody understands that. But what that rule does suggest is that no matter what the equities of a particular situation might be vis-a-vis the lender versus the debtor, the court is powerless to try to even the playing field absent the deficiency judgment, which is entirely in the discretion of the lender.
But on the other hand, Your Honor, if there's property that is worth $2 million and the debt is $1 million, and the lender either bids $1 million or bids $100 and forgoes the rest of the debt, so the lender's essentially bid $1 million. If the property's worth $2 million, somebody else may have come in and bid that if it's really worth that. Or the debtor can arrange financing.
Just as Alvin could show up after this morning.
Exactly.
Well, you know what I'd like to know from your expertise is what would happen if, and we can use it as a hypothetical, the lender has a judgment for $1.7 million, bids on the property for $100, gets the property, and then pursues a judgment for $1.7 million minus $100 against the debtor. Tell us what happens.
Well, in that circumstance, Justice Albin, the statute 2A:50-3 would apply, and the debtor is entitled to a fair market value credit.
Okay, so now we're going to have a hearing for a determination of fair market value. And let's say the court determines the fair market value is $2.5 million. What happens?
At that point, under the law as it exists today, the debt is wiped out, and the parties are left where they are. If the property is really worth $4.5 million, the debtor had the ability within the market, the private real estate financing market, to bring somebody in to bid that, to get financing, to bid higher than the outstanding indebtedness.
So
there are remedies within the process.
So if the lender filed this action for the payment of the remainder of the judgment, and there was a counterclaim saying, wait a second, that was worth $2.5 million. I want $800,000. You're saying? Saying that counterclaim has to go by the wayside? Counterclaim has no vitality? You following me?
If you're saying counterclaim, do you mean a motion for a fair market value?
Yeah, saying that, look, you got a windfall. You had a judgment against me for $1.7 million, and now you're coming after me for a double recovery, but the truth of the matter is the property is worth $2.5 million. I want the difference. You shouldn't be getting $800,000 more dollars above the judgment that you have against me when my property was worth 2.5. Go ahead.
But section 50-3 of the statute, I think, makes it clear that the fair market value credit serves the function of wiping out the deficiency, and that's all it does.
So at the end in that situation, the debtor, Justice Albin's situation, the debtor would not have a judgment against the creditor for the deficiency.
For the excess.
And that's the problem that we have here.
Yes.
We have a judgment against the creditor for this deficiency.
Right.
Correct? And you're saying that can't happen under the statute, and that's not equitable.
Under the statute, the fair market value credit wipes out the deficiency. The case law says that. Now, I understand in this case, Section 50-3 doesn't strictly apply because we're dealing with a judgment creditor and we're dealing with commercial property. But I think that to the extent that a trial court has the right and obligation to exercise its equitable authority, that authority should be circumscribed by what the statute says.
You're saying, as your colleague said, that how is it equitable if the creditor at the end of the case ends up owing the debtor a judgment when the creditor never collected on its judgment?
Exactly.
Right.
Okay. That's one of our problems.
What would it do to the lending market if a borrower acquired this commercial property, defaulted on their mortgage payments, and then end up not only with evisceration of the deficiency judgment, but also payment of the increased value of the property in a rising market? What public policy is advanced by encouraging people not to pay their mortgages and end up with a bonus?
Well, I think the problem that my organization and my members have is that at this point, until this court speaks, we're not sure what the effect of this judgment, this opinion of the appellate division, if this court affirms it, is going to be out there in the market. I mean, if I'm a lender and I know about this case, am I going to subject myself to a potential liability, as happened to the U.S. Home in this case?
Well, it hardly
seems. They'll have to figure out some other way to collect the debt, take other security.
It seems a disincentive to the lending market.
It can be a real problem. I'm not sure exactly how much, but it can be a real problem.
How about in the case, like a simple case of a homeowner who borrowed $200,000 from the bank, property's worth $500,000, the family has fallen upon hard times, cannot pay the mortgage, now there's a foreclosure action. And let's say they put in the bank is only owed $200,000, the property is worth $500,000. Is that family going to lose its $300,000 in equity in a case like this?
Is there
any equity? They haven't paid anything yet. That $300 equity, isn't that illusory? They haven't paid anything
yet. They just can't. The guy lost his job.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You're saying there's a $500,000 balance outstanding.
It's the fair market value of the property is $500,000. The bank is owed $200,000. The family cannot pay the mortgage anymore. The bank now forecloses. Okay. The property is valued at $500,000. Does the family that's down on its luck lose everything? Under your analysis,
they would have their debt retired because if there's a fair market value credit, it exceeds the amount of the outstanding indebtedness. So they would walk away, generally under the law as it is now, with no house and no debt.
Doesn't 2A50-2.3 speak to residential property and make adjustments for the kinds of situations Justice Alvin is talking about?
Well, I think on the facts of this case, Section 3 is really the operative section.
I know, but if we're switching and now talking about residential property in which people live, I thought 2.3...
2.3 would more directly
would
apply.
Directly address that question.
Yes, Justice Levesque.
Yeah. Thank you.
Could I ask about your second point, your second headline, where you suggested, you argued that you have to have a contemporaneous determination if you were to go down the road you're seeking us to avoid, and not determine fair market value years later. Underlying that, I think, is the notion that it's impossible to do it years after the fact. Yet that's the very issue that takes place when experts present testimony and are probed and cross-examined and questioned so that we attempt to avoid the rosy-colored view that hindsight affords. Can we, as a court, accept this presumption that it's impossible to make an assessment years after?
I think you can. I think it is very difficult 3.5 years later and 5.5 years later, as occurred in this case, to reach a valuation at that prior date, especially where the prior date was in the midst of a horrible recession and the market had greatly recovered at the time these valuations were made. But courts do that
all the time. Condemnation proceedings.
Well, they do.
After the fact, they through expert testimony, and through expert testimony that's often vigorously cross-examined, courts figure out or try their best to figure out what would have been the fair market value at a particular date.
I think it does occur in other contexts, but to answer the Chief Justice's question, what we're arguing, and I think the court rules would require this, is if I foreclose and I want a deficiency judgment, I ask for it in the foreclosure action. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the valuation for purposes of the fair market value credit is made contemporaneously with the foreclosure action, with the sheriff sale, not years later. So that you don't run into this problem in a straight mortgage foreclosure of a post-hoc valuation, which is what we had here.
I have one more, Chief, if I may. Had Mr. Greenberg indicated that his client is not intending to do anything with its $1.7 million judgment, what if it had attempted to execute on that judgment back several years ago while this action was still at the trial court level? How would the statutes have dealt with that attempt? And what I'm getting at is maybe there's no windfall here or double recovery, but could there be if someone aggressively pursues a judgment after getting the property in a sheriff's sale for $100?
If the creditor's foreclosure action or judgment sale, as in part of this case, and request for the deficiency are contemporaneous, that avoids most of those issues.
Right, but there was no deficiency action in this case.
There was not.
Had they pursued the judgment in lieu of a deficiency action vigorously at that time, could they have ended up with a $1.7 million judgment, the property, which could have been a rather significant recovery?
Well, as I understand the facts, and Mr. Greenberg is the fact person here, if they had pursued a deficiency, the judgment would have been $1.7 million.
Right.
The bankruptcy valuation was $1.2 million. So most of the deficiency would have been covered by the market value.
Right.
I'm asking
whether if they had actually tried to execute on that judgment they had against the debtor.
Yes, if they did.
If they did.
Yes.
They could have ended up with both of those things? With both the judgment, the money from the judgment, plus the property.
If it had gone that way, hypothetically, yes, Judge Patterson.
Anything you'd like to add?
Excuse me?
Anything you'd like to add at this point?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Plyer.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to, I think it's important for everyone to remember that the only issue that U.S. Homes has appealed is the 4G's property. They did not appeal the appellate division's decision with respect to the West Pleasant property. They accepted the appellate division's determination, the application of the foreclosure first rule. They accepted the value that the trial court assigned to the property, which was $1,895,000. And they accepted the lot yield. They also accepted the value per lot, which was $109,000. The other issue that I wanted to address was the representation that this was a single property. It was not. 4G's is an entity completely and separately owned from West Pleasant. 4G's is literally the 4G's family, the Glory family, George Glory, Walter Glory, and their wives, Clara and Denise. They have no business interest. They don't hold any positions within the West Pleasant organization. Similarly, the West Pleasant organization is a family-owned business. It's owned by the Campbell family, with John Campbell being the president of that organization. And they, too, don't have any ownership interest in the 4G's property. The land was completely separately owned by each business entity, so to represent that it was a single property is a misrepresentation to this court. As I was preparing for today's oral arguments, I reread the Federal Title versus Lowenstein case, and there was a short sentence that resonated with me. It says, "Equality is equity. It would be unjust to permit the mortgagee to extort double satisfaction from the mortgagor, and it would be equally unjust to compel the mortgagee to accept inadequate security in satisfaction of his debt." The reason I mention that is because there's been a lot of comments about the conduct of West Pleasant and 4G's, and U.S. Homes has taken the position that they didn't act equitably. I'd like to go back to the 2005 time period when this contract was actually entered into. At that time, on August 9th of 2005, when West Pleasant and 4G sold their property to U.S. Home, that contract was worth $8.4 million. West Pleasant was selling 100 acres under the original contract, and 4G's was selling approximately 70 acres. Just about 2 weeks later, West Pleasant entered into an option contract giving U.S. Home the right to purchase an additional 47 acres known as Lot 2. The lots have since been renumbered, but at that time it was Lot 2. That option pushed the contract over $11 million. About 3 weeks later, West Pleasant signed a mortgage and a note in favor of U.S. Home, in which they were to get an advance of the deposit monies in the amount of $1.5 million. And that's the reason why I bring up the Lowenstein case. It is unfathomable to think that U.S. Home would not have gotten adequate security for that $1.5 million. The ink was barely dry on the option contract and the original contract when U.S. Home advanced the $1.5 million and got a mortgage. A year later, U.S. Home demanded their money back. They canceled the contract. They demanded their money back. And instead of simply foreclosing against West Pleasant, what did they do? They demanded arbitration, and they proceeded to arbitrate against both West Pleasant and 4G's, keeping in mind 4G's never signed a mortgage, and they never signed a note. From 2006 until 2007, in fact, until April of 2008, U.S. Homes never foreclosed on the property. Instead, they proceeded with the arbitration against West Pleasant and 4G's. Why would they do that?
But they had didn't the agreement security. Make them joint and severally liable for both?
That was what the arbitrators determined.
I thought your contracts provided that either property could be jointly and severally liable and that they could proceed in whatever order they chose.
And in fact, the law even gives them the right to do that, but knowing that they had adequate security simply bought through the West Pleasant property, they chose a very convoluted path. They decided to arbitrate. They got an arbitration award in December of 2007. I've been involved in this case since February of 2008, off and on.
Well, so how much was that amount for? What was the arbitration award for?
It was for $1,510,000. $10,000 was deposited into the attorney trust account of John Novak, and he returned that money. So it was $1.5 million plus interest. And then immediately, instead, they still didn't file a foreclosure action. Instead, what they did in December 2007 was they filed a complaint to confirm the arbitration award.
That was the amount of the original mortgage, correct? The $1.5 million, that was the amount of the advance.
The advance.
Yes, that was the
amount
that
they're trying
advanced.
To collect back.
That's
their
correct.
Money out of pocket.
Yes,
there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's legal to do, right?
I'm sorry?
They were within their rights to do that.
They were within their right to do it.
Aren't they also required to file to confirm the arbitration award but within a certain time period? So that was proper, too.
I'm not saying that anything was proper. What I'm saying is that there was another avenue that they could have pursued. They didn't have to go through the arbitration. They could have foreclosed against West Pleasant.
OK. Can I ask you one threshold question? I think I'm okay. What is the windfall that you claim U.S. Homes received here? What do they have in their pocket that constituted a windfall in this case?
They sold to themselves the property, as we know, each property for $100.
Okay.
Those properties were determined through a fair market value hearing to be
in the law division.
Approximately $4
million. In the law division.
Right, in the law division, yes, that
so
is correct.
So it's the difference between what they paid minus what their judgment was against the total $4 million value, and that is what you claim their windfall is.
Well, applying it the way that the law division applied it, the windfall was actually the value of the 4G's property, because what the appellate division said was that apply it to the West Pleasant property and they don't get the balance on that because of the consent order that was entered into at the bankruptcy court level. So once you apply the foreclosure first rule, it extinguished the mortgage that U.S. Homes had against the West Pleasant property, and what that means is they never should have proceeded against what the 4G's property, which was valued at $2,398,000.
So if the fair market value was $2.5 million, and you knew that they were coming after you for the 1.7, and they might bid 100, like, why weren't you selling it? Like,
if
the fair market value was 2.5, maybe you could have gotten 2 million. Like, why are you allowing your property to be sold for $100?
Mr. Campbell did, in fact, attempt to get bidders for the property. Unfortunately, he just wasn't successful. The market was bad at that point in time.
Well, that raises the question that Mr. Greenberg has said this, like, post hoc valuation. It was bad at the time, but several years later when they're doing this post hoc valuation, it seems to be really good.
I don't believe that that's correct. If you look at the, when we went through the fair market value hearing, the experts on both sides, both U.S. Homes as well as West Pleasant and 4G's, what they did was they got literature from when properties sold. They looked at properties that were sold in that time period that were
But you said Mr. Campbell was trying to sell the property, couldn't sell it for 2.5 or 2 million, apparently probably couldn't sell it for $1.7 million, but then gets the benefit of a court-determined valuation of 2.5 years later?
Well, I think that there's a difference between not being able to find bidders and the value of the property. It doesn't change the value of the property. The value of the property is still the same.
But I think you just commented that the real estate market was such that you couldn't get somebody to show up with a check for $10,000 to the sheriff's sale. Maybe not in a market where there's a glut of properties on the ready for development on the market in that area.
But it still doesn't change the value of the property.
Well, the valuation of the property, it doesn't change, but it does reflect, as you comment, and I'm agreeing with you, that at the time the bidders are not out there ready to pay $10,000 and satisfy the judgment, or because it wasn't worth.
Well, I don't know that the property wasn't worth it. The bidders just they didn't bid on the property, but the property still had a value to it.
Sure, it does, but like one way of valuing property is what a willing buyer and a willing seller would come to an agreement about, right? And you're telling us back then in that depressed market wasn't any willing buyer coming forward to purchase the property.
We only know that the individuals that Mr. Campbell went to weren't willing buyers.
Correct if I'm wrong. I thought you started by saying that he couldn't get buyers because the market was depressed.
Yes, the market was depressed. That is correct. But
is it still
but
that
again,
now, or has it?
But again, it doesn't change the fact that the property was still worth $2.4 million.
As of what date?
As of December 7, 2010, which was the date of the sheriff's sale of the 4G's property.
And what's the date of valuation that was used in the law division?
December 7, 2010, the date of the sheriff's sale.
When did the law division? The
properties, I'm sorry, the properties were sold on two different dates. The 4G's property was sold first, December 7, 2010, and the West Pleasant property was sold on January 25th, 2011.
Sorry about that.
When did the law division make its valuation that the property was worth 2.5 in December of 2010?
That was in April of 2014, following a 3 or 4 day trial, at which time there were experts that testified on both sides.
For purposes of this appeal, based on the record we have and the arguments that have been advanced, is there a reason for us to reject the determination by the law division of the fair market value?
No, I don't believe so. I think that the testimony supports the evaluation of the 4G's property. There were several days of testimony given by experts who looked at all of the records and made the determination that based on a property, other property that was selling in this period of time, the 4G's property was evaluated at $2,398,000. And I think that there's also support for that. The MMU case is a case in which 5.5 years later, the judgment debtor sought a fair market value credit, and the court made the finding that a court has the inherent equitable authority to allow a fair market value credit to prevent a double recovery from a judgment creditor who is seeking to recover from a judgment debtor.
What do you say to your adversary who might claim that at the time of the sheriff's sale, I wouldn't have purchased that property for $2.5 million. I put $100 up. Like, why 4 years later should someone value that property at $2.5 million and now saddle me with an $800,000 additional payment? How could I foresee that some law division judge was going to do that to me?
I think that with U.S. Home, it would be very disingenuous for them to say that the property I would never have paid that much money for the property when, in fact, they had originally offered to pay almost $11 million for the property. And during the bankruptcy hearing, they had not just one evaluation of the 4G's and West Pleasant property. They had several. There was...
But the bankruptcy court valued both properties at just $1.2 million.
And the bankruptcy court value was not preclusive. It did not apply at the time of the 4G's, the sale of the 4G's property. Under the case law and under the statute, the period of time at which time a property is to be properly evaluated is when the sheriff's sale occurs. And that wasn't until December of 2010.
Other questions, anyone? Anything else you'd like to add?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Greenberg, do you want to offer a brief rebuttal?
Thank you, Chief Justice Ratner. I'll try to be brief. You heard from counsel about the Lowenstein case, which dates back to 1933. That's apparently the strongest authority that plaintiffs have. The Lowenstein case said exactly what all the other cases have said and what we've said here. The mortgagee will not be permitted to retain the estate, which will, in effect, become absolute in him upon confirmation of the foreclosure sale, and also recover the debt, which is the consideration of that estate, by an action on the bond, except and until he credits upon that bond the fair value of the mortgage premises. Lowenstein was the first case. All the other cases have said the same thing. There is no problem unless there is both an acquisition of the property and a deficiency judgment. You heard several times that the value of the contract from 2005 somehow is probative as to the value of the properties at the operative dates, December 2010 and January 2011. With regard to that, I would invoke Justice Albin's stock market remark. The fact that properties were thought by parties to be worth what they were thought to be worth in 2005 has no bearing whatsoever on valuation in 2010 and 2011. You heard a concession from the plaintiffs that their client apparently tried to get bidders at the 2010 sheriff sale. It's not reflected in the record, but let's accept that. You were also told that it was unsuccessful. The whole purpose of a sheriff's sale is to create a market for properties that have been foreclosed on or as to which there's a judgment. If bidders do not appear at the sale, that says that there is no market for the property at any reasonable price.
It could also tell us what we know, and that is that banks were not lending money in 2010. So even if the property was worth $2.4 million, it would have been very difficult for a developer to come forward if the banks weren't prepared to provide a mortgage. Aren't there any number of possibilities that could have affected what happened on the day of the sheriff's sale, independent from the actual worth of the property?
Well, that's true. The entire market environment, Chief Justice Ravner, was one of paralysis, whether from a lending standpoint, as Your Honor is indicating, and also from a transactional perspective, as I think Justice Albin was inquiring of counsel, why didn't you sell the property to someone else? There was no ability to do any of those things because the market was frozen, and the expert appraisers all agreed on that. Everyone who has lived through that knows that. So that's the reality of what the market was. You heard about the MMU case, and the MMU case is perhaps the poster child for a case that has no applicability here. In the law division, prior counsel for West Pleasant was asked about the applicability of the MMU case, and at page 219 of the appendix, which is a transcript from that proceeding that was attached to a certification below, that counsel said that MMU was unique on its facts and that the case wasn't applicable here. Now we hear that MMU is a prize case for the plaintiffs, but it's not. It involved a situation where the creditors sold the property within 1 month of the sheriff's sale for an amount of money. I think it was $1.2 million. The creditor conceded that the property was worth that same amount at the time of the sheriff's sale 1 month before. So there was no controversy about what the property was worth or whether there was a deficiency or not. The sale occurred within a month of the sheriff's sale. That's the circumstance that Mr. Washburn suggested should be part of this court's calculus, that there should be a virtually contemporaneous proceeding or an agreement, in that case in MMU, as to the value of the property. In light of those particular equitable circumstances, the court reached its conclusion. But more importantly, the holding of the case was that under NJSA 2A:17-44, there was to be compensation to the property owner to the full value of the real estate sold because there had been a reversal of an execution judgment. That's what that statute covers. That's the holding as to why the plaintiff, the property owner in MMU received the full value. It wasn't because of the particular facts, although if it were because of the particular facts, those facts aren't present here. In short, all that you've read in the briefs, all that you've heard this morning, comes down to the fact that these persistently slippery plaintiffs, West Pleasant and 4Gs, are now unjustifiably trying to wrap themselves in the cloak of equity in order to perpetrate an injustice on U.S. Home. This court should not allow that and should reverse the judgment below.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to all counsel for the very fine argument.